Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now onto the episode. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. With me, your host, Francesca. So in today's episode, I wanted to talk about the menstrual cycle with regards to how it changes as we move into our 40s, into perimenopause, but how we can still leverage all the various phases of a, let's call it a regular menstrual cycle, even though we have moved into perimenopause and things are changing a little bit. Because at the end of the day, we are having menstrual cycles right up until we reach menopause. So we still need to be able to understand our menstrual cycles. We should still want to be tracking our menstrual cycle. If you're not already tracking your cycle, I definitely encourage you to start. And it's simply just knowing the day that you first started that cycle. So day one of your period being day one of a new cycle. So you would, for example, track that in, let's say, an app that you might use, or you might just want to use good old diary and pen and paper. The apps are just easier because you can just open the app and sort of see an overview. And there's plenty of free versions of all the different apps that out there. So you don't have to necessarily pay. I've never paid for any of the apps that I've used. I currently use an app called Cycles, and there is a paid version. But as I said, I don't necessarily need that version. I just want to be able to plug in. This is the day that I've started my period. And then from there onwards, I can just know on any given day what day of my cycle I am. So I know when to expect the next one. But as we go through today's session, what I want to explain is how we are likely to feel and experience life as well through the different phases of our menstrual cycle. So if I open my app every morning, which I do, and I know what day I'm on, I have a rough idea of what to expect, or if I'm feeling a certain way, I can say, well, you know, it is this part of my cycle. So it really helps me to kind of understand myself better, and also to know that, well, it's normal that I maybe feel this way on this particular week of my cycle or this particular day, but I know that come next week or come even tomorrow, depending on where I am, I'm going to feel different. I'm going to feel better. So it's really empowering just to know on any given day where you are in your cycle, but then to also understand the different phases, which is what we're going to talk about today. And as I said, because when we move into perimenopause, our cycles do eventually start to change, not always straight away, but they do eventually start to, for example, they get shorter for a while, and then they can start to get longer for a while, and you go, you know, much longer without having a period, for example, which is essentially long cycles, until eventually the body goes 12 consecutive months without having a period. That day, when you have gone a full year without having a period, you have reached menopause. And at that point, you know, you're no longer in your menstrual cycling years. But any time before that, you are still in your menstrual cycling years. So whilst the phases that we're going to talk about today across a menstrual cycle won't necessarily apply when we're very close to going 12 months without having a cycle, because, you know, we'll have gone 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, 9 months, and so on without a cycle. So therefore, what I'm going to talk about today wouldn't necessarily be applying in that time. But for anybody who is anywhere from 35, late 30s, early 40s, mid 40s, if you, whatever age, whether, you know, some women are still having regular periods at 48, 52. I know women who are in the kind of early 50s and they're still having bang on every month a menstrual cycle. So whatever age you are, if you're having regular cycles, this episode will apply to you. So I just want to give you a deeper understanding of the different phases of a menstrual cycle. And then we'll also talk about, before we go into that, what does start to change as we move into our 40s and through our 40s in terms of our periods and our cycles. So regular menstruating years would be from a couple of years or so after puberty. So after your first ever period in your teens, give or take, a couple of years after that first period, it takes that length of time roughly for our periods, for the brain and ovaries to get used to talking to each other all month long, and for those hormones to cycle, for your ovulation to happen halfway through the cycle. It can take a couple of years for that to really start to kind of calibrate, if you like, from when we first start having a period. So regular cycling years will start, let's say, late teens, early 20s, but throughout your 20s and usually early 30s, we are in that regular menstruating years phase of our life. And then we move into phase two, if you like, of menstruating years, which is perimenopause, essentially, because everything starts to change as we move into perimenopause. Like I said, not straight away. We move into perimenopause physiologically from kind of late 30s, early 40s. Menstrual cycles may not start to change for everyone straight away, but they usually have started to change in some way. And I can tell you about how mine changed. But what's still happening here is we're still having relatively regular cycles. We are still fertile right up to reaching menopause. Remember, we're waiting to go 12 consecutive months without having a period. But in those months, before we've actually reached menopause officially, we can have a period at any time. And then the clock starts all over again, waiting to go that full year without having a period before we can say we've reached menopause. So that means while we're in that time where we're waiting to go 12 months without having one, we can still be fertile. So we just need to be aware of that if it's something we want to avoid. So in the early stages of perimenopause, for most women, cycles are still regular, but they're perhaps shortening, maybe by a day, then maybe by 2 days, then maybe by 3 days and so on. So anywhere up to kind of 5 or so days, your cycles can start to shorten in the early phases of perimenopause. So let me use myself as an example. So when I turned 41, so throughout my whole 20s, 30s, my cycles were usually 27, 28, 29 days. For the most part, they were 28 days. Late 30s, the second half of my 30s, they were bang on 28 days. And then as I moved into 40, they were still 28 days. When I turned, just after I turned 41, they were then becoming 27 days every month. I was no longer seeing the 28 days. So I thought, okay, maybe this is the start of my perimenopause shortening of my period, my cycles. And then by the time I was 43, they had gone down to 26 days for the most part. Very, very rare did I see a cycle that was 27 days. They were always 26. Now I am 45 and my cycles have gone down to 25 days. So they've gone shorter by 3 days over the course of the 5 years since being in my 40s. And then what will probably start happening later on is that they'll start to lengthen in length. So they may crawl their way back up to 28 days, but then eventually, probably quite soon after that, they'll get longer. There'll be a longer gap in between my cycles. And then, you know, eventually my body will get to that stage where it's going, it's 12 months without having a period, but that could still be 5, 6, 7, who knows, however many years away that is for me. No, it doesn't really kind of matter whether you have, let's say, 30 day cycles and your friend has 26 day cycles or 25 like me. You can still work, both of you can still work with the phases of the menstrual cycle that we're going to talk about today. It's just when they get very few and far between, you know, you're going 6 months, 3 months, 4 months without having a cycle, then, you know, you don't necessarily know where you are on any given day. So very hard to work with the phases that we're going to talk about today. But if you're having regular cycles, then definitely listen to the rest of this episode. This is really empowering stuff that I'm going to talk about. And if you kind of make little notes on it and track your cycle, like I said, using an app, ideally, and just know on any given day where you are, then it can be so helpful just to help you kind of navigate your weeks, your days a little bit better and easier, and give yourself some grace as well. That's what I definitely find. Okay, so an average cycle length, we're just going to use for the sake of today's explanation, an average cycle length of 28 days. But normal healthy cycles range anywhere between 21 days and 35 days. So mine have shortened by 3 days. So they are now 25 days, but they're still, although it is a short cycle, it's still normal. I'm still not, you know, worried about that at all. It would just be if it went below 21 days that I would start to maybe think, okay, what's going on here? And then when they get longer than 35 days, that isn't, you know, that's not normal anymore. But if you're in the later phases, the later stages of perimenopause, it is normal for that age. It's just if you were, you know, in your 30s and your cycles are 35 days, longer than 35 days, you might want to get that looked into. So I'm going to outline a typical cycle before perimenopause. And then in a minute, I'm just going to explain the little shifts that occur once we're in perimenopause with that cycle. So basically, day one of a cycle is day one of your period, day one of proper bleeding, proper flow, not just spotting. So you should know that, you know, the difference between, oh, this is just a bit of spotting versus this is an actual flow. So day one is day one of the cycle, day one of the period, same thing. It's also known as the follicular phase, the first half of a menstrual cycle. So the first half of a menstrual cycle is called the follicular phase. The second half of a menstrual cycle is called the luteal phase. The first anywhere between 3 and 7 days of the follicular phase is also known as the menstruation phase, menses, that's your bleed, but it all falls within the follicular phase. And in this phase, right up to midway through your cycle, progesterone is very low, practically not non-existent. And estradiol is the main active estrogen that we have. So estrogen, estradiol, same thing for the sake of this episode. So estrogen is very low around day one, day two, day three of your period. But then it gradually starts to climb up from around day five, day six, it starts its climb. And it keeps gradually climbing all along. So day five, day six, day seven, day eight, day nine, it's climbing. And then about 2 or so days before you're due to ovulate, before your body's usually going to ovulate, we see this big spike, this big peak in estrogen, which is really nice. We really enjoy that because it makes us feel good. Estrogen gives us more confidence. It makes us feel more sociable, more outgoing, maybe more extroverted than different times of the month, more energy. We might feel more attractive as well. Our skin might feel better, more plump. So during that first half, estrogen is working to thicken the lining of the uterus to provide a nourishing environment for an egg to be fertilized and, you know, to implant and develop. And when an egg is released, so that's successful ovulation, which is around halfway through the cycle. So if we're looking at a 28-day cycle, it would be roughly day 14, could be day 13, day 14, day 15, progesterone is made as a result of that egg being released. And then for the last 2 weeks of the cycle, the luteal phase, we enjoy the benefits of having this robust amount of progesterone, hopefully. And progesterone stabilizes that uterine wall, which was getting built up by estrogen during the first half and stops it from getting too thick, but keeping it just right. So the two hormones work together to kind of make that uterine lining a lovely place to implant an egg. But they are also so much more than that. But let's just stay on the topic of ovulation. So if the fertilization of an egg doesn't occur, there is no pregnancy, progesterone then drops towards the kind of end of the luteal phase. It drops very low, and so does estrogen. And that triggers the shedding of the uterine lining, which is essentially your period, day one of your next period, day one of your next cycle. So the last few days before a period is due is when progesterone and estrogen are very low. And then the first few days of that new period, that new cycle, progesterone and estrogen are very low as well. So it could be, let's say, roughly 6 days. I like to just, for myself, I kind of say it's about 6 days, a few days before my period, a few days into my period, very low estrogen and progesterone. Those are the times my energy is going to be at its lowest. My mood might be a little bit off. It shouldn't ever be anything more than just mild. You know, you shouldn't have like this horrendous fatigue. You shouldn't have these awful headaches. You shouldn't feel extremely upset and low and sad and depressed. It all should just be very subtle. Anything more than subtle is not a great, you know, that's a sign that there's some sort of imbalance there. And we really want to look at that. Like maybe you're not making any progesterone, or you're not making enough of it, to kind of help support those symptoms just before, like when those two hormones are low. So Essentially, the takeaway message at this part is that a healthy menstrual cycle is an ovulatory one, which basically means you ovulate about halfway through your cycle, whatever length it is, and you make progesterone as a result of ovulating. If we don't ovulate halfway through, we don't make progesterone. So as I said, that ovulation is how we make progesterone, and we need to make progesterone because the two hormones work together. So essentially, estrogen, it's natural that estrogen dominates, in inverted commas, the first half of the cycle, because remember, we don't have any progesterone in that follicular phase until we've ovulated. That's how we make progesterone. So in the first half of the cycle, we have estrogen climbing whilst you're bleeding, say day three or four, and it climbs and climbs and climbs. It gets really nice and high just before ovulation. Then it dips a little bit, but it's still there. After we ovulate, estrogen dips a little bit more, but we still have it throughout the entire second half of the cycle, but we have more progesterone than we do estrogen. So in a normal cycle, estrogen dominates in the first half, progesterone dominates in the second half, and that is hormone balance essentially. So let's just quickly talk about how progesterone is made, because I'm talking about how we ovulate and then we make progesterone. But exactly how it's made is that during ovulation, a small temporary gland called the corpus luteum is formed during that ovulation process. This small little gland, it's temporary. It lasts the last kind of 11 to 14 or so days, however, you know, depending on the length of your cycle, of that luteal phase. So it's formed during ovulation. It allows one of your ovaries to release a whole load of progesterone into your system around the ovulation time. The corpus luteum forms very quickly during ovulation. And as I said, it lives on for that last couple of weeks of our luteal phase of the menstrual cycle, where it continues to kind of drip feed, if you like, progesterone into our system. So no ovulation means we don't produce that corpus luteum, so we therefore don't make any progesterone. Or ovulation but poor corpus luteum formation can mean that we do make progesterone, we just don't make as much. And that can also lead to hormonal imbalance because we don't have enough progesterone. We don't have as much as we should for it to be a really healthy cycle. So no low or no ovulation becomes more likely and frequent during perimenopause because, and the further we move through perimenopause. So as we're moving into our 40s and anywhere from late 30s, we're not having as many successful ovulatory cycles. We're having more what's known as anovulatory or non-ovulatory cycles, meaning we don't ovulate halfway through anymore, don't ovulate at all. That can be 1 month that we don't ovulate, and then three that we do, and then one that we don't, and you know, and so on. Or it could be that there's three in a row we don't ovulate. It really depends on the person. And it also depends on a whole load of other factors, nutrition and lifestyle factors, because they play a huge role in the body's ability to successfully ovulate. But of course, being in perimenopause, one of the natural characteristics of it is that we ovulate less. But it's just that we can do things nutritionally and lifestyle wise that can support us to ovulate more months than we would have if we didn't intervene. And that's what's so powerful about this work, is that, you know, if we just know a few helpful lifestyle habits and nutritional habits that can support the body to ovulate, we can just have more months ovulating, so more months with progesterone than we would have had without it. It's something I personally work really hard on, and I track every month, every day. Across my menstrual cycle, I track my baseline body temperature, which basically means as soon as you wake up in the morning, you stick a thermometer in your mouth before you get out of bed and just see what your temperature is. And I write that, I note that down in my cycles app against the day of my cycle. And then I know what my temperature should be, because your temperature spikes a little bit when you make progesterone, basically. That's what we're doing here. So if you get a little spike, maybe of point, anywhere between point sort of two and four or something of your temperature after when you believe you've ovulated, and that temperature spike is sustained until your next period comes, you can safely say that you did ovulate, you did make progesterone, and you've kept it, you've had it with you for the last couple of weeks of your cycle. So I track that every morning across the cycle. And for the last 5 years, so I'm 45 now, for the last 5 years, I can count more or less on one hand the amount of months I haven't had that temperature spike, which means I haven't made progesterone haven't ovulated. And I really, really do put that down to the nutrition and lifestyle habits that I have in place, that I have just made part of who I am, part of my normal behavior. And if I didn't do those things, or I was doing other things that I'm not doing, I don't believe I would have had as many months as I have making progesterone, managing to ovulate and making progesterone. So I'm really, really passionate about supporting women with their ability to ovulate, basically, and not from a fertility point of view, but from a perimenopausal point of view, where it means we can make progesterone and enjoy the benefits of it. I talk about the benefits of progesterone in loads of other episodes, so I won't go into it so much today, but essentially it's a calming hormone, it supports good sleep, it supports just generally how we feel in terms of contentment with life, and it's anti-anxiety. So it's it's helpful for the brain. It supports water retention, kind of puffy fingers, and it balances out estrogen. So we really have to have both of those hormones together. Otherwise, if we have an estrogen dominant cycle, basically meaning that we have estrogen in the first half and estrogen in the second half that isn't counterbalanced by its partner hormone progesterone, our next period can be very heavy, very clotty, very painful. Lots of PMS before that period. We could have headaches, migraines. We could have mood swings like anger, rage. And breast pain. These are very typical symptoms of estrogen dominance, basically meaning that estrogen is not balanced out by its partner hormone, progesterone. So when those months where I haven't made progesterone I know that because my temperature is lower, like it doesn't spike in the second half. I definitely have that. I have the breast pain. I have a heavier, clottier flow. I have PMS, basically. So it's very, very important that we are looking at ovulation as something, as a tool to make progesterone and enjoy the benefits of it. And, you know, in a nutshell, throughout your menstrual cycle, your brain and your ovaries go back and forth communicating with each other. And this is how signals are sent from your brain to your ovaries to make each hormone and for ovulation to occur. So another thing that's really helpful to understand is that if it's the brain and ovaries that are communicating with each other, if there's a lot of stress there in a person's life, a lot of mental stress, emotional stress, physical stress, it does impact that brain to ovary communication. And therefore, the ovaries may miss the signal from the brain some or many months to ovulate. Or the brain doesn't want to send that signal because it doesn't want the body to ovulate because it doesn't see it as a safe environment. So we really have to support ovulation by, we really have to support ourselves with stress, basically, because another natural characteristic of being in perimenopause is that the brain to ovary communication does change. It isn't as robust anymore. And if we know that stress is going to impact that even more, then we must look at stress as something really important, non-negotiable, as we move into perimenopause to manage stress, to think about our lifestyles, to really look after ourselves and, use this as a time to say, right, there's just no getting away from it now. We've always known that we should be managing stress, but once we're in perimenopause, we have to. It really does make things a lot easier for us physically, mentally, and emotionally. So, whilst the cycle is always working to prepare for a potential pregnancy throughout our whole reproductive years, our cycles, cycling of our hormones, is so much more than just fertility. And in fact, I hate the term reproductive years. That's what we're here for. And, that's what our cycle, the only reason for our cycles. It's not. These are our menstruating years, I prefer to say. Like, we are menstruating from the first period we have as a teen right up to reaching menopause. So there are menstruating years, but it's so much more than just fertility. We want the ebb and flow of estrogen and progesterone to occur all month, month after month, throughout our menstruating years, because their production manages and safeguards so many different aspects of our health, both now and later: metabolic health, bone health, brain health, immune health, ability to make muscle, manage inflammation. They are so, so important. So we just really want to understand estrogen and progesterone. They work together all month long to build that long-term health, really safeguarding our future health, and also just supporting us in the moment with symptom management. And it's kind of like, see it every month that we cycle through those hormones, we're adding to that kind of health bank balance, both now but also in the future. That the more exposure we have, you know, to healthy levels of estrogen and good amounts of progesterone every month, it's adding to that health bank balance for the future. So yeah, and I think what we just want to understand is that when we move into perimenopause, whilst our cycles and periods, they do change, and eventually towards the late stages of perimenopause, cycles become fewer and further between until we eventually go 12 months without having a period. The whole time we are still cycling, there is so much we can do to support a healthy menstrual cycle, you know, just as much as possible. It's never going to be as easy as it was in our 30s because we weren't in perimenopause. Perimenopause is naturally characterized by that, like I said, that change in brain to ovary communication and therefore the change in our menstrual cycle, but we can support it. And I hope my example of myself with the, you know, over the last 5 years up to 45, I'm still managing to ovulate most of the time. And therefore I make good amounts of progesterone. But one thing I will say is that where my periods have got shorter, my cycles have got shorter. So it used to be 28 days. If you imagined, let's say that I ovulated around day 14, for argument's sake. When my cycles were 28 days, I enjoyed 2 weeks, roughly, say 12, 13 days of progesterone in my system. How wonderful. And I did that every month. Now that my cycles are 25 days, if let's say I'm still ovulating around day 14, 15, I'm actually only getting progesterone for 10 days instead of 13, let's say. And so it's still great that I have it, but I'm having it for a lesser amount of time. And one thing that I'm noticing in the last, say, 6 to 9 months is that my temperature spike, after I'm taking my temperature every morning, my temperature spike isn't actually happening now until around day 17, sometimes day 18, which means I'm ovulating later into my cycle than I was before. So I'm making progesterone, I'm getting that temperature spike, but the temperature spike isn't happening until around day 18. And then my next period comes around day 25. So I've got like 7, 8 days with progesterone compared to what I used to have, which was 14. So that impacts as well. And these are characteristics of perimenopause. I'm better off with the progesterone than not having made it at all. But I'm also only having it for you know, I've got like 3 or 4 days less than I used to have before with its lovely benefits. So this all feeds into, you know, the typical perimenopause symptoms that we see, the sleep issues, anxiety, just feeling more irritable, you know, typical ones related to progesterone, I mean. So whilst I don't really suffer with those symptoms to any particularly bad extent at all, I am starting to notice in the last 6 to 9 months that I'm starting to feel that I do have less time with progesterone. I am starting to feel it emotionally, physically, mentally, and my periods are very heavy when they do come. They're not necessarily very clotty or painful, but they're much heavier than they used to be. So it just may be a conversation that I'm going to potentially have with a doctor, possibly next year, as I'm moving to more sort of towards 46, if it stays like this, because I may consider taking body identical hormone therapy for progesterone just for the last kind of, you know, over the next few years, because I've still got good levels of estrogen. Most women don't, their estrogen doesn't actually start to decline until the later stages of perimenopause. And I'm not in the later stages of perimenopause, so I'm not worried about estrogen right now. I'm thinking of progesterone. So I may have a discussion with a doctor in 2025, which we're nearly in now, but in 2025 to just see if it's something I might consider taking to help me feel a bit better. But I don't feel particularly bad at the moment at all. So I'm not there quite yet. So as I said, when we move into perimenopause, what changes is the brain to ovary communication isn't as clear as it used to be anymore. And so we have this erratic nature now of estrogen. So this is starting anywhere from late 30s, early 40s, but it becomes more wild, more erratic, the further we move through our 40s. It remains pretty wild and erratic right up until we actually go that 12 months without having a period. It's just that in the kind of early to mid-ish phases of perimenopause, so maybe roughly, I'm just using kind of average ages as an example, but roughly up to around, let's say, late 40s, we've pretty much got quite high levels of estrogen. Most women, you know, contrary to popular belief, is that estrogen is declining as soon as we become perimenopausal. That's not true. It's not really declining until the later stages of perimenopause, closer to estrogen. So before that, we tend to have much higher levels, in fact, sort of 2 to 3 times higher than ever before. And I've mentioned this in previous episodes. I think episodes 2 and 3 were my most explainable episodes of perimenopause. So go back and listen to those if you haven't. But we tend to have very high and fluctuating levels of estrogen right up until the later stages of perimenopause. Then it becomes lower and very wildly fluctuating still. And then once we get to menopause, that's when we have low estrogen and practically none after that. So the erratic nature of estrogen, the more cycles, we also get cycles that are non-ovulatory, becoming more frequent. But as I said a million times, there are things we can do nutritionally, lifestyle wise, that support the body to ovulate more months than it would have had you not intervened with those habits. But that is on another episode. I can't remember the number, but I've got an episode on progesterone, how to support it. So go back and listen to that. It's in the title. So essentially, let's just have a look at the phases of the menstrual cycle then. So follicular phase, as I said, is the starting on day one of your period, day one of your new cycle. And that is roughly, for the sake of this podcast, I'm just going to say it's roughly 2 weeks long if we're looking at a 28-day cycle. Then we have the ovulatory phase, which is around 24 hours. In a 28-day cycle, that is roughly occurring around day 14, but give or take on either side a couple of days. Then after we've ovulated, whether we ovulated or not, actually, we then move into the luteal phase. So hopefully we have managed to ovulate. If we haven't, we still, either way, we move into the second half of the cycle, which is called the luteal phase. That lasts roughly for 2 weeks, right up until the day we come on our next period again. And then the whole cycle starts again. We're back in the follicular phase and so on. The luteal phase is interesting because although it's the last half of the cycle, roughly the last 2 weeks, it's actually a tale of two halves. The first week, pretty much okay. The second week can be quite different to the first week. And that's really a week to kind of really start to put more self-care in place. So I'll talk about that more in a second. But let's kind of talk a little bit more about what's going on in the follicular phase. So the drop in progesterone towards the end of the cycle, remember, if the body, you know, realizes we're not pregnant, essentially, then we get this drop in progesterone and that triggers the shedding of the uterus and therefore a new period. That marks day one of a new cycle, day one of your period. Estrogen and progesterone are at their lowest here. They're at their lowest a few days before your period. And as I said, the first few days of this new period, new cycle. So our energy wise, we might feel lower in energy, maybe have a bit of a flat mood. There is a potential for a headache or a migraine if you're one of those unlucky people to get that. So essentially in this phase, adhering to these kind of first few days of your period, let's call it bleed week within the follicular phase, adhering to the signal to slow down, like the signals that your body's giving you here. You know, I'm bleeding now. I've got low energy. I don't feel very motivated. My mood's a bit flat. I just want to, you know, we all know that our body is signaling to us to slow down, hunker down, maybe go a bit inwards and set it. If we adhere to these signals, it really will set you up for a better time later on in your cycle as well. Things can feel a little bit easier if we just adhere to these signals and, you know, allow that rest as much as we can in the first few days of our bleed, you know, in any way that you can. Everyone's situation is going to be completely different in terms of whether that, you know, how much rest they can have and how that might look for them. So just thinking about your own unique situation in any way, how can you slow down if you're not already slowing down in this, you know, your bleed week? How can you incorporate a little bit more rest, a bit more of a slowing down in that time for you and your own unique situation? Pushing when we shouldn't be pushing just works against our body, against our hormones. It just doesn't feel good in the moment, but also later on in the cycle, we can usually pay for that pushing at the wrong time. You know, if we've been pushing at the wrong time of our cycle, we tend to pay for it later. So as I said a minute ago, estrogen then starts to rise about halfway through your period, or let's say your period was 5 days, estrogen will start to rise, let's say around day four, day five. Here, energy and mood will start to improve, start to feel a bit more motivated, a bit more outgoing, like kind of ready to come out of our shell a little bit, just feeling a bit better. So we can liken the bleed week to the winter of our cycle. It's that time to just go inwards and hunker down and rest as much as you can. And, you know, your body is sending those signals to slow down, to stop, to get cozy, to hibernate. And it, like I said, it will really set you up for a better time. So winter of your cycle is that bleed week towards the end of your bleed. We're moving into spring. Hormones are, you know, estrogen starting to come up a little bit and we're starting to feel a bit better. So considerations for that bleed week in terms of exercise would be, you know, try and have a day off. If you're somebody who regularly exercises, maybe you lift, maybe you do some kind of other intense training of some sort. Maybe day one and day two of your cycle is days off from that particular exercise, those particular workouts. But definitely get walking. We don't want to be inactive ever. So walking is really soothing to the what's known as sacroiliac joint. Sorry to anyone who is like a physio and they know exactly what I'm talking about and I've said it completely wrong. But there's a particular joint in the pelvis where the pelvis kind of like meets the lower spine. And it's really soothing to be walking whilst we're on our period for that part of the body, which can be quite achy. We might also have achy joints at this point because estrogen and progesterone are very anti-inflammatory. So when they're very low during bleed week, we can have this like achy feelings of achiness. So walking is really soothing. Preferably doing that in some kind of nature would be much, you know, really beneficial in different ways as well. Doing some gentle, very gentle yoga. If you're like me, you might not like doing any yoga when, you know, going upside down when you're on going into downward dogs and stuff. If my period is really heavy, it's not what I want to do. But there are certain yoga poses that I quite like and I find them quite gentle and I don't mind doing them when I'm on my period. So again, whatever suits you, but something gentle, walking, qigong is lovely to do. You're standing up whilst you're doing that and it's just really gentle and calming. Around day three, you should use day three, day four, depends on the person. You might start to feel up for, if you're lifting weights, doing strength training, then you should start to feel up for it around that day. But you might want a slightly lighter load, maybe higher reps, lighter load. And that's what I do around that day. And then towards the end of the week, when my period's finished and estrogen is really rising, then I feel more comfortable then increasing weights and doing less reps. I'm much heavier and I'm back in the... So for example, today, I'm day seven of my cycle today. So my bleed finished 2 days ago. I'm now day seven. I went to the gym today and it was a completely different story today compared to 3 days ago. I went on day three. I had nothing. I did my workout because I wanted to move my muscles. I still wanted to lift, but I did the much lighter and I went higher reps and a lighter load. Today I went in like a power woman. I was heavier than I went up much heavier than I did like last week. And you really do find that, you know, as women, we're not linear. We can't just, for example, if we're weightlifting, just be doing higher, getting higher and higher and higher incrementally week on week. There are weeks we have to come back down and then we can go back up even higher than we were before. And then we'll come back down again before our period when we're feeling not as strong. And then we'll go back up again even higher. So it kind of goes like that instead of linear, because we are not linear beings as women. So again, going back to bleed week, any type of cardio could be nice. You know, if you've got it in you, steady state cardio, maybe like a really gentle jog if you want to, but you just want to keep it very gentle. I personally just stick to my walking. I do some gentle yoga. I do lots of lovely qigong. And then, yeah, I get back into my strength training around day three upwards. And I'll do some interval sprints most weeks of the month, apart from usually bleed week, I don't do them. So nutritionally, in terms of what you might consider for bleed week, you're bleeding. So you want some blood building foods here. So this is a great time if you like liver to use it, to eat it, make homemade liver pate, chicken liver, beef liver. It's so nutritious. It's so full of all the lovely blood building nutrients that we really need, the iron, the zinc, you know, just so rich in really helpful nutrients to give us that energy, that B12. Bone broth is really lovely here as well. You know, as I said, liver's great, but even if it's not liver, then beef, good quality beef cuts, lamb, eggs, chicken thighs, really nice blood building foods here to support you. If you're somebody, so I always recommend the 14-10 fasting rule. What I essentially recommend for women in perimenopause is that they have a minimum, at least a 12-hour fast overnight between finishing dinner and starting breakfast in the morning. So if they finish dinner at 7:30, they wouldn't start breakfast until 7:30 in the morning. So they have a good 12-hour fast. I've got a separate episode on this. But what's really great is if you can push your fast to 13 or 14 hours. And I've personally been doing that for the last 10 years or so, and it just works really, really well for me. It's my sweet spot in terms of when people talk about intermittent fasting. It's essentially eating, you know, you can also call it time restricted eating is the better way of putting it. And it's basically making sure you have a good fast between finishing dinner and starting breakfast the next day. Like I said, minimum 12 hours. I personally do 13 to 14 hours. And then I eat all of my three meals across a day in a window of 10 to 11 hours. So I personally start my breakfast at 9 and I finish my dinner by around 7:30. So I've got a 10 to 10 and a half hour eating window and then a 13 and a half to 14 hour fasting window between dinner and breakfast. And you know, most of that time I'm asleep or just chilling, watching TV before I go to bed. And then in the morning I'm getting ready for gearing up to having my breakfast. So you don't really, it's not like you're fasting during the day when you're trying to work and all those things. So if during bleed week, you can actually push your fast a little bit longer than you might usually do. So I only go to a maximum of 14 hours. But in bleed week, I can push it if I want to. I could push it to 15 hours, maybe 16 as an absolute maximum. I don't necessarily do it on purpose, but I could. And I can also, during bleed week, you can kind of handle being a bit lower carb. You don't want to be no carb, but you could get away with eating a little bit less carbohydrates and kind of make the most of that sort of 4 or 5 days of your bleed where, you know, you really want to be focusing on lovely protein, good fats, lots of lovely fiber from vegetables. And you don't necessarily need as much carbohydrates as you would in the other parts of your cycle. In terms of emotional well-being during your bleed week, it's a great week for kind of mulling things over, thinking about what the rest of your month is going to look like, solving any problems that have been there through the previous weeks. Now's that time to sit and go inward and figure things out for your way forward. What needs maybe to change? How can I do things differently if need be? What's not working? Making any plans or setting kind of goals for that month. But you're not really going to get started on them until your bleed's finished. But it's just a really good time to work things out and mull things over, making sure you're prioritizing good sleep and rest that week as well. Your body, when you're bleeding, you will need more sleep. So go with it. If you need to go to bed earlier, if you need to wake up later, just do that because it's a great time to get more sleep where possible. And prioritize restorative evening routines. I mean, we should be doing this anyway all across the month, but really prioritize it in bleed week. You know, like I said, getting to bed earlier, not setting the alarm for stupid hours in the morning to get up and work out. You know, it's not a week to be doing that. And your body and your mind will really thank you for the extra hours and the extra restoration that you've given it in the, you know, during the rest of the month. And then we move into the follicular phase. So, well, we're already in the follicular phase, but it's bleed week. And then after menstruation, we're in the rest of the follicular phase, which is, as I said, like the spring of our cycle. Now estrogen is rising, working to start developing the one primary follicle that will eventually release an egg, hopefully in about a week, and allow you to ovulate and therefore make progesterone. During this spring of your cycle, which we can roughly say is from around about day 6, day 7, up to for another week, up to when we're supposed to ovulate halfway through. Testosterone is also rising in this phase. So we'll feel stronger. We might have more libido, not just sex drive, but sort of libido for life itself, zest for life. We might have a bit of a mood boost and just generally feel quite good. Then we are, so some considerations for this second half of the follicular phase. Exercise wise, we can probably leverage that strength that we've got from more estrogen, from more testosterone, you know, more energy, more strength, lift heavier, go for a personal best if you're that way inclined in the gym. If you want to, you know, if you want to lift your heaviest in the month, this is the time to do it. Put your best efforts in. If you go sprinting, you know, go faster. In this particular time, you can probably give it a little bit more. Nutrition wise, we are what's known as more insulin sensitive here. I've talked about this in previous episodes. Insulin sensitivity is really, really important. It's something we start to lose actually as we move further through perimenopause. But when we have lots of like healthy levels of estrogen, we are more insulin sensitive, which basically means that the body is more efficient at, the cells in the body are more efficient at soaking up all of the glucose that's released into the bloodstream as a result of our carbohydrates, for example. So because we're more insulin sensitive here, we can handle more carbohydrates, more than we could in, for example, bleed week and the few days leading up to our period. So it's not a time to be low carb. It's a time to make the most of all this new energy that we've got and strength, support that with healthy levels of carbohydrates, and then make the most of being more insulin sensitive. In terms of protein, we can definitely increase it in this week. I say that everybody anyway should be having a minimum of around 100 grams of protein per day, but you could probably have a little bit more in this week and really help to boost that muscle building from, you know, from your lifting efforts if you are hopefully lifting weights as part of your normal life. In terms of fasting, you definitely, the only time I would say that going up to a 16-hour fast overnight is okay, essentially, for women in perimenopause would be that bleed week. Anything after that, I would definitely be going back to your 12-hour or 14-hour max fast overnight, because anything more than that might actually impact ovulation when it's due to come, because your brain may perceive that there's a bit of a stressor going on here because you're pushing your fast too long, your stress response is kicking in, and then, you know, your brain won't signal down for ovulation to occur. So we don't want that to happen. Emotionally wise, your mood might feel brighter, you'll sleep a little bit more restful, you might feel more sociable, happier to be around people, a little bit more extroverted. It's a great week to socially network, business network, you know, arrange your social engagements for this time. I definitely work my social calendar around my menstrual cycle, so I never book things in, whether it's to go and visit people or meet people or have people round, if I'm due on or on. I just need that time to be as quiet as possible. Obviously, as I said, everyone's unique situation is different, and you can only do what you can do. But I just tend to do what I can to limit any kind of big social, you know, lively engagements around that time. And it just works really well for me in the follicular phase to be doing those things. Even the most introverted person can actually start to feel more of an extrovert in this particular spring of your cycle. Then we move on to the ovulation phase, which is kind of like the summer of the cycle. It's the main event of the cycle. As we said, you know, we want to ovulate halfway through so that we make progesterone. And we're going to have more energy here, feel more sociable, more outgoing. We might be really smashing through work that we've got, projects. Our mind is sharper. We're feeling stronger, as I said, in workouts as well around here. We're lifting heavier. When we're in meetings or presenting or whatever it is we might be doing at work, we might just feel more sharp. I think, why do I feel like this now and not other times? It's because this is just the way of our hormones. So they just work differently throughout the month. And I'm hoping that this is helpful to give you more of that explanation. So after we ovulate, then we move into that luteal phase. As we said, hopefully we've ovulated. Hopefully we've made lots of lovely progesterone from it. We're now into the luteal phase. Whether we ovulate or not, we move into the luteal phase. It's just going to be much easier in this phase if we've ovulated, because progesterone will support us in these last 2 weeks of the cycle. Luteal phase, as I said, we can split into a tale of two halves physically and emotionally. So the first week, where we still should have lovely higher levels of progesterone, we should feel calm, we should feel grounded, our mood should be okay, our energy should be okay, as long as that progesterone is there, because it's anti-anxiety, it's calming. We've still got a relatively goodish amounts of estrogen as well, so our energy and mood should still be okay as well. And every monthly dose of progesterone made as a result of ovulating helps to reduce inflammation. So aches and pains shouldn't be, a problem. It helps to regulate our immune function. It supports our thyroid, our brain, our bones, our breast tissue, our sleep, our mood. So by supporting breast tissue, it means it would prevent breast pain in the lead up to our next period and so on. And the length of this luteal phase, it's usually, like I said, in an average 28-day cycle, it's usually around 2 weeks. But the length of the luteal phase is really based on how long that corpus luteum temporary gland that's formed during ovulation, how long that releases, continues to release progesterone into the system. So for me, like I said, my cycles have gone from 28 days to 25 days. So my corpus luteum is only releasing progesterone up until day 25 versus what it was before, which was day 28. So I have a shorter luteal phase, which does suggest lower progesterone than I was having before. But that is, you know, that is characteristic of perimenopause. I'm not worried about it. It's just something I'm keeping an eye on because I want to have good levels of progesterone. So this is where I said, you know, I may have a discussion with my doctor about taking progesterone, body identical progesterone therapy for a while. So the second, yeah, so kind of exercise, nutrition and emotional well-being considerations for this first week of the luteal phase would be that, you know, we can continue to be as we are in the gym, we continue to maybe lift heavy or go harder, but just maybe not as hard, not as heavy as the week before. Do any cardio that you enjoy, if you do any cardio, but again, we don't want to be doing anything crazy during, 40 plus. I've got a whole episode, previous episode on exercising in your 40s. But, you know, if you enjoy steady state cardio, lots of lovely walking, all of this stuff, yoga, Pilates, whatever it might be, lifting, continue to do this now. But as I said, if it's really intense, heavy lifting, you just might not feel as strong as you would have last week, but you're still going to be stronger than you will be next week. Nutritionally, the cells in the body start to become less insulin sensitive as we move further through the luteal phase, closer to our period, because estrogen is dropping, and estrogen is a hormone that supports insulin sensitivity. So this basically means that we maybe can't handle as high level of carbs and sugar as we could have, a week ago. So just good to keep that in mind and stick with, you know, your good quality, lots of lovely protein, your good fats, plenty of different colors and types of vegetables, and good quality, complex, slow release carbohydrates like your whole grains, your beans, your legumes, your starchy root vegetables, but just don't go overboard. Emotionally, it's kind of like the autumn of our cycle. So winter being the bleed week, the luteal phase is autumn, but you've got that first half of autumn, which is the first week of the luteal phase, and then the second half of autumn where things do get a little bit, you know, darker and less, you know, if we look at the actual, think of the actual seasons out there. So the first half of autumn being still quite close to summer, and then the second half of autumn being a bit closer to winter. So that first week of the luteal phase, we're just moving into autumn. We've still got estrogen, we've still got progesterone. So we're feeling pretty good, you know, emotionally, mentally, we should be anyway, as long as we did make progesterone. We're feeling calm, centered, focused. We can still kind of get on with things. It is a great week to still be getting on with things that need our attention, accuracy, good articulation, for example. And then as we move into part two of the luteal phase, which is getting closer to winter now, this is when estrogen is starting to decline, progesterone is starting its decline. We've still got it, but it's just declining. So lower energy, lower mood potentially, maybe sleep changes. Maybe just not feeling as bright as we did a week before. So from about 4 to 3 days before our period is due, this is when the PMSy time is coming in. This, interestingly, if we think about from an emotional point and mindset point of view, these 3 to 4 days before our period is due, we can start feeling, there is that potential for feeling quite self-critical, quite pessimistic about life, about things that are going on, maybe a bit of anxiety if progesterone is much lower, irritability, sleep issues. We might have cravings here for potentially, you know, particularly for sugar and carbohydrates. There is potential for a headache or a migraine. We might have some gut issues here, a bit of bloating, maybe some loose stools. And so it's really a time to manage stress again, you know, manage that rest as much as we possibly can. But also be mindful of the fact that if we are feeling quite self-critical and pessimistic, try to remind ourselves, this isn't how we always are. This is how I tend to be at this particular time of my cycle. Therefore, I'm going to accept the way that these thoughts that I'm having, but I'm not going to let them take a hold, because I have to remember that in a week's time or a week ago, I wasn't feeling this way about myself. So whilst you don't want to gaslight yourself and say, no, it's not real, is it, you know, do we want to give it as much life and energy as, you know, as maybe we shouldn't? Because it's the time in my cycle when my hormones are very low and I kind of tend towards feeling pessimistic and self-critical. So if we can just sort of remind ourselves of that, it can help us to just kind of like, okay, these thoughts are here, but they're not always here. So let's just not let them take too much of a hold. And evolutionary wise, we just need to remember women and hormones, we're not meant to have a lot of stress in the week before our period, these few days before our period and while we're in bleed week. We are meant to try and, you know, just have as a restorative time as we can and be kind to ourselves and just give ourselves what we need in as much as we can. As I said, everybody's situation is completely different. So you have to apply this to your own, you know, unique situation. But essentially lower intensity movement again here, like walking, yoga, being in nature more is really helpful. I personally find being in nature a few days before my period and while I'm on is so helpful for my mindset. Yoga as well, I find really helpful for my mindset here as well. And just still going to the gym, I'll always want to lift throughout the month. But as I said, I just take the reps up and the weights down. I might have longer rest periods. I might knock off the end of my workout if it's a little bit too intense for that particular week. But yeah, I'm still doing those things. They're just at a different intensity. And you'll want to manage your appetite here with and your cravings with more protein, focusing on good fats and slow release carbohydrates as opposed to the, you know, refined carbs and lots of sugar here. Although you might be craving the sugar, think, okay, am I eating enough food? Firstly, it's natural to be needing more food from protein, from good fats, as opposed to, you know, from sugar and refined carbs. But if we're not basically nourishing our bodies enough, it's going to manifest as cravings for sugar and carbs when actually what we want is more protein. So yeah, I think that's the kind of main considerations for those few days before your period. Be aware that you might be easily irritated, you might be less tolerant of people, as I said, more critical about yourself, a tendency to view things more negatively. And that's essentially one of the reasons is because we have lower levels of serotonin and lower levels of dopamine with the low estrogen here. But yeah, again, if we can tell ourselves, okay, I'm feeling less tolerant of XYZ right now, but this isn't always the case. And is it because my hormones are pretty much on the floor at this stage? And when my period comes, they'll start to climb back up again. So whilst everything I've talked about today is characteristic of more of a regular menstrual cycle, and when we're depending on where you are in perimenopause, you know, it would depend on how much all of what I've talked about today can apply. But we can still leverage the different phases of the cycle and understand what's happening in each of the phases to our advantage, even in perimenopause. I really hope that some of this has resonated with you today and that it's been helpful. And if it has, I'd love to hear from you. If it hasn't, I'd love to hear from you. Either way, as I always say, my email address or my Instagram handle is in the show notes. So do get in touch with me with any comments, any questions, any feedback. I'd love to hear from you. Yeah, just to know if any of it has been helpful, if any of it resonates, if you already live by your phases of the cycle, how that's working for you and what's changing for you in your, as you're moving through your own perimenopause, what stage you're at in your 40s and what stage your periods are at. I would love to hear from you. You know, your feedback and insight is really helpful for me as a practitioner. So do feel free to get in touch. And that's it for today, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye-bye. If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy. Or you'll also find the link in the show notes.